Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. It's the hottest September 5th since 1945, and this might perhaps be the hottest show of Season 2 of Baseball Talk. In studio here, we have a familiar face returning for the first time this year, Rob Whiteman. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I love the Expos hat on there. As listeners know, I'm a huge Expos fan from days gone by. And we have another great guest here to talk baseball with us. We have Canisius University, a Division I school from Buffalo down in the States, last year's MAAC champions. Their head coach, Matt Mazurek, played some pro baseball himself. He's joining us here on the line. Welcome to the show, Matt. Sorry, in all the excitement, I forgot to mash a couple buttons. Are you with us now, Matt?
Yeah, I'm with you guys.
There we go. Good. First of all, let's talk about what's going on with the Canisius baseball program right at the moment.
Yeah, so right now we started classes last week, and we gave the guys a week of acclimation to their studies and academics, so they can get a feel for the whole college process. And now this week we're starting initiation into our program in terms of teaching them the verbiage, the ins and outs of what's expected of them on the field within our program, kind of dissecting the defensive side, the pitching side, their daily throwing work, their workouts, and then the hitting side and the base running side as well. So it's like bringing them in, learning all the fundamentals of what's expected within our program.
So your baseball players, your main season is in the spring. So do they have to report earlier than September? Like, you know, sports such as football and such, you'll have guys showing up in August, early August and such. When does it actually kick off for your players?
Yeah, so our guys don't show up until they have to, until school starts. So school started August 27th. So our guys, our new players, the freshmen moved in on the 24th of August just to get acclimated with orientation to the school. And then, you know, our guys, all the returners, the upperclassmen, returned on 25th, 26th, you know, the Saturday, Sunday before they started classes on the Monday. So we don't have to come back early in the fall segment.
And you have, we were just talking off air, you said there's some limits on how many exhibition games you guys can play. So in the fall, you're only allowed to play a couple?
Yeah, in the fall right now, you're allowed to play two. The NCAA is working on passing some new rules where we can play other Division I programs in the fall. And they kind of gaffed on the rule this fall where it's two games, where we've always used to have some games, but if you played games against other schools, they would count against your spring schedule. So now two games do not count against your spring schedule, and you're also allowed a international exemption game. So we've always played a Canadian – it's always been a Canadian high school youth team that comes over, and we play them as well in the fall.
I see. Who have you played in the recent years?
We've played the Toronto Mets. We've played the Ontario Royals. We've played a few different teams out of Quebec. And that's kind of been it in the last
year. I was asking because we've had some representatives from a few of the AAA teams on our show. I was just wondering if they were connecting the dots there on that one. Now, this is you're entering your second season as head coach with Canisius. What did you learn in your first season as the head guy there?
I just kind of learned a lot about I've been an assistant for 13 years before I took over as the head coach. And I would tell people that I was preparing every day to become a head coach, and then you really don't – you think you have everything figured out, and then you get a new job, and then you got to figure out a whole set of different things. So I guess I just learned how to, you know, manage the players differently, because when you're an assistant, you're kind of the good cop. You become the head coach, and you literally take on a role of a bad cop, not by choice, but just because you make the final decisions now. So you try to blend it that way. So that was a little bit of a learning curve early on. And then, you know, being an assistant for so long, taking over the head coach, I had to hire an assistant and I had to teach him how to do the job I had done for 13 years. So it was like I'm learning a new job, and then I'm also teaching an assistant, a young assistant who's 24, him how to do, you know, the job I used to do. So it was kind of delegation and juggling and, you know, getting our staff to mesh and get things going. So that was the biggest one. I was lucky in year one to have a veteran team. So we had some 12 seniors. So that part on the field kind of, I don't want to say ran itself, but they did a great job of helping me adjust, you know, help them adjust, you know. So So that part was pretty good. So I got my feet under me logistically in the office and with our assistants on the field. It kind of took care of itself. And then this year we have an opportunity to tackle the 11 newcomers. We come in and kind of create our own culture and vibe of the team moving forward.
Put your own stamp on the team. Now, as far as recruiting goes, how did your duties change going from being an assistant to the head coach?
You know, as an assistant, I was going out there, you know, finding kids, finding names, and, you know, get them to the head coach, and he would, you know, work his way to make the best decisions for what we had, you know, juggling the numbers, toggling the numbers. And now, you know, I'm the one receiving those names from our assistant coach. And then I myself, you know, like that's something that doesn't stop. Like, even though you're a head coach, you're still on the road as much as your assistants trying to find guys. So, you know, I kind of took over going to some places I may not have went as an assistant coach, just to kind of cover some areas that our program's been familiar with, like Canada. So I spent more time there this summer, just trying to, you know, continue to have our stamp in the area, and then, you know, trying to find the best players that fit our program.
And speaking of recruiting, that's actually where, you know, I got the idea for request you being on the show, because last year we had a pitcher that's also pitching in the Intercounty League, Andrew Van Woot, and there's another guy, Jordan Neufeld, who he actually hasn't been on the show yet, but we've talked about it, because he actually, our show broadcasts from a town called Hanover, and Jordan Neufeld was born here, and then later pitched for 4 years at Canisius. His timeline would have been pretty close to when you were there. I believe you were there in 06, and I don't know, did you cross paths with Jordan Neufeld?
Yep, Jordan and I played together for two seasons. So he was actually junior, senior the same year as I was. So
okay.
I spent 2 years there with him, yep.
Yeah, he has some young kids at home there, so it's as far as trying to line up, getting them on the show, it's been a little hit and miss on that one. But hopefully we'll have them on in not too distant future there. But where I was going with all that is you've had quite a history of having quite a few Ontario kids on the Canisius roster. So I wanted to talk to you about that. How do you guys go about recruiting in Ontario? Because in recent years, we have a much more structured developmental system, but it hasn't always been the case. But Canisius has always had a lot of Canadians in their program. Why is that?
Well, first, I can't talk about this without talking about the former head coach Mike McCray. He's a Canadian, so he has a lot of ties in Canada. So that was partly a large reason why we were in Canada, was him and his connections. And then, you know, through time it grew. You know, we get a lot of players out of different travel teams out of Canada. So, you know, and then it becomes word of mouth. They come, they have a good experience, and then they kind of pass the torch down, and their coaches know that they're sending them to a program that will continue to develop their guys and give them opportunities. You know, scouts come, and they, Canadian scouts especially, are going to, guys that are covering Canada, they will come over and they'll see our players, and they'll know that, you know, the players that come out of Canisius are going to be players that they can put a stamp on going to the next level because of the culture and how they're developed. So, you know, I think the proximity is a very good reason why, you know, like maybe there's some kids that don't want to go too far from home but want the Division I opportunity in the States, and we can provide that. And we've had some great success in the past with our winning tradition at Canisius, and that's another attractive quality. So, and I say, like, the Canadian kids, I say this all the time, they come a little bit more battle-ready too, you know, because I think they play a higher caliber of baseball throughout the summers and at young ages. You know, some of them have – some of the players we've had have amazing experiences playing on the junior national team and playing against top-tier competition. So they come in, and you can insert them in your lineup, you know, pretty fast. So that's kind of where the connection comes and why we stay there.
We had a guest on earlier this year. I can't remember if it was Rob Pegger who said this, but he basically said they had a coach, a collegiate coach, tell them that they found that Canadian kids – almost to a person, always have strong arms, and they always wondered if it had something to do with hockey or something like that, but they just always noticed. Is that something you've noticed?
Yeah, majority, there's not many Canadian kids that come in our program that don't. You know, I don't know exactly what that attributes to. Maybe it's something in the water out there.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's the hockey side. But, I mean, on top of that, you always get a lot of they play a lot of different sports growing up. Like a lot of the Canadian kids we get, it's almost like a given. They played volleyball at some point. Like the high school baseball isn't very strong, but they play, high school, volleyball. We have some from provincial champions. We've had a provincial champ in the javelin throw.
Oh, wow.
Like, I don't know how many are throwing the javelin out there, but that's something we can say we've had come from Canada. Like, that doesn't happen over here in the States. So that could attribute to the long arm or the strong arms of the guys throwing the javelin around.
And since we were talking about recruiting in Ontario, but I noticed, too, you had a J.P. Stevenson, who was the 2018 MAAC Pitcher of the Year. And if I'm not mistaken there, he's actually from Prince Edward Island. So, like, how are you getting tabs on a guy from a small island out on the Atlantic Ocean?
Right. So JP, he was an interesting story. So he was a junior national team guy. So you always you look at that roster and you look at the where guys are from and you go there. But we go every year to what's called the Canada Cup, and that brings the best underage players that are looking to go to the next level, right in front of you at a. Every province is there. Their best players are there, and you go and you watch every team compete against each other. Like this year, it was in Moncton, New Brunswick. So you get to see all those guys. And then JP went to a baseball academy out in Calgary, Alberta, so Vauxhall Academy, and we've gotten a good line of players from that program as well. So we've had some ins and some ties with where some of these guys from other provinces come from. Because the best ball players in Canada are going to be heavily, they're going to be well known by the whole entire country.
They're going to make themselves known, yeah. And I believe you had at least one player from Saskatchewan there too.
Yep, like right now we have Carson Perkins, who's on our roster. He's from BNFA, Saskatchewan. He'll tell you it's about 300 people with one stoplight. He was another Vauxhall player. A few years ago, we had three great guys out of British Columbia, and we've had plenty before them out of British Columbia. I think the only province we haven't had a player from is Newfoundland.
Okay, wow.
Yeah.
Talking about your player development and such, you guys have had 13 major league picks since 2009, and last year, since you took over as head coach there, Tyler Smith went in the eighth round to Los Angeles Angels. So how are the ins and outs of that? Like, where do you see Canisius staking its claim as far as a developmental program for MLB?
Yeah, I just think it's we bring in talented kids. We always try to bring in talent. And then we give them every opportunity to put in work to get themselves ready to go to the next level. Like, we have structure here. We demand a lot out of our guys. We want them to be high character on and off the field. So that kind of ties into it. And, we have a wall in our locker room that has all the photos of all the guys that have been drafted. And we can look up there and talk about players who have been drafted, but before they came to Canisius, they may have been only recruited by one other Division I school, maybe no other Division I schools. And, we kind of dangle the carrot. Like, all these guys get drafted because they put the work in. We're going to give you a sound structure and a sound environment to get where you need to get to, but the work you put in is going to dictate, where you end up. And some guys have a strong fire lit underneath them, and they take it. And, having the guys come before them and get drafted, guys come in here and see themselves doing it. And the ones that truly see it and think it's attainable work their tail off, and they end up getting there. So we provide the environment for them to develop and teach them the things that it takes, and then we get the guys that have the drive and the passion to continue to strive for that.
Matt, traditionally, you hear the stories about the guys coming out of high school, getting drafted or signed by a major league team, going through the minors and developing that way, and eventually hopefully making the show. Are you finding the college route is becoming a more preferred route? Because we're starting to hear more and more from these guys, and we're seeing more and more people coming, more and more guys coming from the collegiate side rather than the minors in the old traditional way.
Yeah, you're gonna see it coming from the college ranks more and more, because maybe some of those guys, and I can, there's a bunch of Canadians that I can just think of. Names are slipping me right now, but they may be just kind of on the fence, and they may be drafted in the 26th round or the 30th round out of high school, and that may be not the right money slot that they're looking for. They'll go to college, and they'll be put in an environment where they're going to be baseball only. And that environment, you're talking baseball, you're talking weight training, you're talking structured, and with our schools, like, you get hands-on tutelage, and people are, you know, from the nutritional side, from the weights and the athletic training staff, and just where things are going when it comes to analytics, you know, they're learning so much more once they get into a college setting, so they're developing both mentally and physically, and they're coming out ready to go. So I think more kids are seeing that there's more opportunities to develop their game as opposed to being a 17-year-old, you know, quirky, may not be the most coordinated kid, may can add some size, and if you go there, you may not be mentally mature enough to go in and be on your own playing professional baseball. They spend a few years at school, and then they mature both as a person and a player, and they're ready to go by that time.
And since you talk about late bloomers, it's probably a good time to bring up the fact that back in 06, when you were playing at Collegis, when you were a player, not a coach, one of your teammates there was a real classic late bloomer. He had played 3 years at another school for the Notre Dame Fighting Irish, and then he was at Canisius for, I believe, a year of grad school. And I'm talking about John Axford, who started the year with the Jays and has now moved on, but that guy's had a pretty great pitching career since then.
Yeah, he really has. John was actually my roommate. He was at my wedding. I was at his wedding. So I've kind of had a front row seat to his journey, and it's been pretty amazing. You know, from the days of him coming to our apartment in Buffalo and his girlfriend's little white Chevy Cavalier, you know, and we're pinching pennies, and now he's a major league player. Like, it was unbelievable. But he had the work ethic. He had the drive. You know, Notre Dame kind of kicked him to the curb because he had surgery. And then, you know, Mike McRae kept tabs on him through his after he was a guy that got drafted out of high school and had a substantial financial offer and turned it down to go to a prestigious university and get his degree. And he has that. And he came back to Canisius, got his master's degree, but then, you know, figured it out from a physical standpoint on the mound. He always had the fastball. Like, that was, you know, when he's at Canisius, it was 93, 94, but you didn't really know where it was going. And then he just developed and took off. You know, had to be told no a few times by both the Yankees, Notre Dame, the Yankees, and, you know, and then he kind of picked it up and ran with it, and he is where he is now. So he's a really cool story.
Yeah, and for our listeners that aren't certain there, at one point, I'm blanking on the year, it might have been 2011, he had 46 saves and was the Rule Aids relief pitcher of the year. So definitely substantial major league career. He's been with, I believe, 8 teams now. And, you know, what was interesting this year with John Axford is after Roberto Osuna, you know, had his lengthy suspension and was no longer available as the closer, they were often using John as a setup man. And I couldn't figure out why they wouldn't at least give him a shot there when they were rotating people through the closing role. I was always surprised they didn't at least see what he could still do there.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it became like John got comfortable in his role and he was doing very, very well for them. And I think when he's kind of been pushed around in his role, it's kind of been his output's been sporadic. So I think they just found something comfortable and they looked at the history and they kept him there. They didn't need to put him in that, I guess, closer role when they had, I really don't even know who they were using in that back end in that spot. I know Clippard was kind of switching on and off with X.
Yeah, and Tapera, and yeah. They had a few guys going through there. Yeah.
Yeah, I think his value, I think they may have seen his value at the trade deadline to another team as like that setup role, so they didn't want to shift it around on him.
Now, after you played 06, you were the Canisius Male Athlete of the Year. You had a .355 career batting average in your 2 years with Canisius, so you had a pretty successful collegiate career yourself. And then you moved on and played 3 years of independent ball. Two of those years, I noticed, were in the Frontier League. So I got to connect the dots on this. We had Rob Pegg on earlier, and he actually was a Frontier League guy himself. He had played for the Canton Crocodiles. You yourself played for the Rockford Riverhawks, and before that, you played with the Joliet Jackhammers. So tell us a little bit about what was your independent pro ball experience like?
Yeah, so the pro ball experience, like, that was, I was like every other kid. I had a great, you know, great career at Canisius, and felt like the major leagues were the next step. Thought about, or was thinking that I was going to get drafted. Went through, jumped through all the hoops. Draft came and went. You know, you're listening to the radio, waiting for your name. It didn't happen. And then I actually had a Canadian scout, Jay Lapp, had, you know, brought me up, gave me an opportunity to try out for him personally, to kind of put a stamp on me. I signed a one-day contract in Hamilton in the IBL, and, you know, we thought things were going to work out and move forward, and they didn't end up doing that, and I still felt I had more to chase, so I went the independent route, and that was an interesting situation. It started with playing in the New York State League, which happened in Utica. It was like a one-year league that popped out of nowhere. It was four teams, and then just a bunch of guys that were chasing a dream, literally living 11 guys in a three-bedroom apartment, their mattresses all over it, getting $500 a month. And then out of that league, guys would get plucked to go to other leagues, like the Northern League where Joliet was, or the Frontier League. And that league actually folded within 4 weeks. So the league folded. I'm driving back to Buffalo. I got told, hey, why don't you start your coaching career? So I was recruiting one day in Syracuse, and then I got a call that said, hey, Joliet needs a guy. So next day I'm in my car. I go to Joliet. I serve as a bench guy. It was an older roster, so you're looking at guys that had a cup of coffee in the big leagues, older veterans. They got up to Double-A. They're probably 35, 36, still chasing it around. The stadiums were great. You know, we played up in Winnipeg. Edmonton was also in that league. So it was kind of like me, the young kid on an older team, and I just knew my role. My role was pinch runner, pinch hitter, defensive replacement. One guy got hurt. I got an opportunity. I ran with it and played the final 17 games pretty strong, and then that led me to – they actually ended up getting rid of the coaching staff after that season in Joliet, so everyone on the roster got released. And then Rockford picked me up, and that was a younger league. So the Frontier League, I think, aged out at 26. I was, you know, in my prime at 23, 24, and I had an opportunity to latch on and play in that league. And I think I had the opportunity for 2 years to play in it because I became versatile. You know, I wasn't just a one-position guy. I could play some infield if I needed to be. But overall, that experience was very worthwhile. It kind of leapt me, kind of allowed me to see things from a different perspective, the player's perspective, which helps me today as a coach. You know, people ask that, you know, would you go back and do it differently? And I say no, because it was like 3 years of a internship, but you're playing, you're learning from other guys who have been up, other guys from other colleges. So I became a sponge, kind of talking to guys and learning from the coaches we had, like both learning what to take, what I can add to players I coach back at Canisius, and what I can kind of see and how guys react, how guys don't react, what makes guys tick. So overall, the experience kind of helped me get to where I am now. And I always joke that spending 3 years in independent ball literally took 3 years off my life. So if I'm 28, or if I was 25 or 28 when I got out, I was really only 25 because I spent those 3 years in independent ball.
Yeah, and you were talking about it being an internship and you being versatile. I'm just looking at your stats here on Baseball Reference. And like in the 09 season when you were with Rockford, positions you played here. Let's see here. Three games at first base. Played a game at third. You caught one game. In center field for 14, in left field for 47, and in right field for 4. So talk about, you know, the opportunity to see the game from every angle and actually play it from every base. In your previous season like that too, I didn't see you catching any games, but you played all over the place. So what a fantastic learning opportunity.
Yeah, and like that helps me now. So like I know that if there's players on our team that have only played right field and move it, if I can't just say, hey, you're going to move to left, you need to give guys reps in left, because it's a different world when you're playing on the other side of the diamond if you've only played on one side before. You know, every guy's going to tell you center field is the best spot for them because it's neutral, right? So you've got to be able to figure out the different angles. But it gave me an opportunity to see things from a different perspective. And a funny story, like I was always an outfielder in independent ball, and then on one road trip, our shortstop didn't bring enough contacts for the road trip, so he couldn't see. So we had limited players, so like, who can play infield? I said, I can do it. And that's how I became more of a utility guy, because the guy forgot his contact. So I just took the opportunity and ran with it.
That's hilarious. It just brings back to mind, I remember playing high school football, and, you know, we have some long distances to cover to get to other schools here, and we made the trip up Dolan Sound one day, and of course, you know, lo and behold, one of our better linebackers had forgot his shoulder pads, and you're like, you only have one job, man. Just bring the shoulder pads and put them on, but that's right. Fun. Now, I know you're a busy man. You want to get on to other things, so I'm going to leave you with one last question before we go. I happen to have a degree from Niagara University, and I know the Purple Eagles are a little bit of a rival for you guys, so just talk a little bit about your rivalry right there.
Yeah, it's a rivalry between Canisius and Niagara. We're 25 minutes apart, you know, and you need to have rivalries in college sports. It's what brings the fun out of it, you know. And a few years ago, it wasn't much of a rivalry. Niagara wasn't very strong baseball-wise. They've been up and coming the last few years. You know, like last year, they beat us a couple times. We ended up beating them a couple times, so it was kind of split. You know, and then it just continues to go. Like, the colleges have a strong rivalry. It's called the Canal Cup. So we have a barrel that every time Canisius plays Niagara in any sport, whoever wins gets points added to a pot. And at the end of the year, whoever has the most points gets to keep the barrel in house. So it becomes a bit of a pride thing. So anytime Canisius plays Niagara in any sport, you know, there's a lot of electricity around the building, a lot of electricity at the field. And we go from there. But this year it was kind of cool because Niagara made the playoffs for the first time in 12 years in the baseball side of it. We've made the playoffs for the last 12 years, and we played them in the first round of the tournament. And it was probably our closest, toughest game, and we ended up coming ahead by 2 runs. But, you know, hopefully the rivalry continues to surge, and it's strong, and that's what makes our game fun and our jobs fun.
I know when you're talking about fun games and stuff like that, a couple years ago, obviously being in Ontario, we're not too close to too many matchups, but when I was down in Houston visiting a buddy, we took in East Carolina versus Rice Owls baseball game. And you know what? These teams all have beautiful stadiums, and it's really high-quality ball, and it's inexpensive. So I'm kind of saying this for all of our listeners here. Yeah, if you get the chance, if you live close to the border, you should pop across there and catch some Canisius or Niagara games, because it's really quality stuff. It's if it's right there in your backyard, avail yourself of it. It's real quality ball. It'd be a good afternoon at the ballpark. All right. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I agree with that. You know, there's a lot of people that really don't understand how good the quality is of the baseball that's played just across the border. And, you know, you never know until you see it. So I would encourage as well.
Yeah, just grab your passport and make a day of it. Thanks so much there, Matt Mazurek, for you've been a fountain of knowledge, shared some great stories. And all the best to Canisius in your second season as their head coach.
All right, Andy and Rob, thank you guys very much. Take care.
Yeah, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks, Matt.
And I think what we're going to do is we're going to take our first set of a break, and then on the other side, we'll come back and do our Twitter poll and our Clark Ives and talk some Blue Jays after that. So talk to you, or we'll be talking at you soon, Baseball Talk. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Baseball Talk on Blue Water Radio, 91.3 FM, and it's also on Whiteman TV. It's going to air Friday night, 8 o'clock, right after the horse racing is shown on Whiteman, Channel 6. Have Rob Whiteman in the studio with me here, and we were just talking to Matt Mazurek, head coach of the Canisius NCAA Division I baseball team. And, what a fountain of knowledge Matt was.
Great, great interview.
Really, yeah, yep. A lot of great stories, a lot of great insights. And, and that program recruits quite heavily in Ontario and through Canada, so it's, in a sense, it's almost like a Canadian program, even though it's based out of Buffalo in the States. Now, we are going to get talking some Jays, and in a sense, we're going to talk some Jays right now. We're going to do From the Clark Ives, and this one, we're actually going to a newspaper called the Lewiston Journal, which was out of Maine, and we're going to Tuesday, March 22nd, 1988, and for our TV viewers, it'll be up on the screen there, but for our radio viewers, the headline says, Yanks, Jays, Talk Trade, and the rundown on this one, interestingly enough, was in 1988. The trade talk was between the Jays and the Yanks regarding George Bell, who most of you will know that 1987, George Bell was the American League MVP. He had, 47 homers and 134 runs in 1987. But in 1988, he was butting heads with Jimmy Williams. And interesting quote to pull out of this article. By the way, if you ever want to check out these Clark Ives, you can go to my Twitter feed, at Gray County Guy. And it's right there. You can see what we're talking about if you're listening on the radio and want to read what we're talking about here. And the quote from Jimmy Williams is, it's a 24-minute... Oh, I should give the context. Jimmy Williams wanted to move George Bell out of left field and make him a full-time designated hitter. But Jorge saw himself as a fielder. He was not happy about getting the designated hitter assignment. So he was resisting the move. And that led to Jimmy Williams saying, it's a 24-man roster. It's a team roster, and a team does not revolve around one person, whether they're from the Dominican, the United States, or Canada. Every individual has to pull his load. He has a job to do. So there you go. There's a former American League MVP butting heads with his manager. And apparently the Jays were shopping him to the Yankees, hoping to get back Dave Winfield, who at the time was 36 years old. And making $1.85 million at that time, too.
Wow, eh?
Yeah. Interestingly enough, they quote George Bell, coming off of an MVP season, he was rewarded with a two-year contract for a guaranteed $4.1 million. Which isn't that $4.1 million is what Josh Donaldson's getting for like the last few weeks of the season. Yep. To a season he didn't play, he's getting $4.1 million to, you know, have fun in AAA for Cleveland right now.
Mm-hmm. Actually, when you sent this to me, it reminded me of another Twitter account that I follow, 93 Blue Jays, I believe it's what it's called, and it has all these headlines from 92, 93, and in it, George Steinbrenner is complaining that the Blue Jays have the highest payroll in baseball, and I think at that point it was $50
million. Oh, my goodness.
And he was going on about how terrible they were, that they were raising the salaries in baseball. George Steinbrenner, of all people.
Yeah.
But when you sent this to me last night, it reminded me of all the links that Winfield had to the Jays before he actually became a Jay in 92. I got thinking about, you know, killing the seagull in the early 80s there and getting charged in the pregame, you know. And there was always Winfield trade talk to the Jays leading up to 92 when he finally did sign with them.
Yeah, and we were discussing this off air. You mentioned that, you know, if they had followed true, if both sides had gone for George Bell for Dave Winfield in 1988, that probably would have meant there would have never been 1992 for the Jays.
Yep, there probably wouldn't have been a 92 because he would have moved on, and that would have been it. And we would have had to have had someone else at DH in 92, or would we have?
Yeah. And we were saying, too, in this article, in 1988, David Winfield was still, he was 36 years old, and he had a couple years left on a 10-year deal. But after that, he ended up eventually going to California Angels as a free agent. Mm-hmm. And then we were saying, then he played for the Jays, then he played for Minnesota, then he played for Cleveland. So he played until he was like 45 or so. So that guy was just a freak of nature specimen, right?
Yep. And actually a three-sport athlete. Prior to joining or choosing baseball, football and basketball as well.
Yeah, and I believe he was drafted in all those sports.
Yep.
Yeah, just an all-around amazing athlete.
I think he made the right choice.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It was interesting. A lot of players who could, if it was between a football and baseball. Last year we had former Major League player Joe Borchardt on, and he was starting quarterback at Stanford, and he had all sorts of great opportunities for the NFL. But, you know, if you do the math on it, you have a chance to have a very long career in MLB. In his case, it didn't particularly work out that way. Mm-hmm. He says, you know, looking back in his case, he said he was much more suited for football, retrospect-wise. But I can see where he made that decision, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have that a longer-term prognosis as an athlete where, you know, an average career in the NFL can only last 2 years, whereas you can easily last if you take care of yourself, you know.
Wasn't it
10, 12 years in the MLB?
Tom Glavine got drafted by the Kings?
Yeah, as a hockey player,
As a hockey player.
And actually, another one we were talking about this year was a Canadian pitcher for the Angels, Kirk MacCaskill.
Yep.
Who he actually, I knew he had a bit of a hockey background, but when I looked into it a bit more, he actually played a year in the AHL, a full season. He played 4 years collegiately, and then he played a full season in the AHL before he started his Major League pro career. And I also didn't realize his dad was, I believe, Ted McCaskill, who was a notorious hockey goon, mm-hmm. who one of the characters in Slapshot was based on his dad.
Yeah.
Dr. Hook.
Yes, that's it. Yeah.
That was based on, yeah. Yep. So, but yeah, all these amazing multi-sport athletes. It's really cool. So that was our Clark Ives for this week. You can check it out on at Gray County Guy on Twitter. And I just thought it was kind of timely. It was an interesting story, what might have been. And then that whole idea of, you know, a recent American League MVP, you know, butting heads with teams. We're probably going to talk about that soon. But I am going to quick kick it over to our Twitter poll. And I believe Adam in the booth here is going to describe it for our radio audience, and he's going to get it up on the screen here for our Whiteman viewers.
So, I sure am, but I'm going to take this opportunity to talk about another player that played a long career, too, that we're familiar with, Pat Borders. He had, like, an extensive career, and he's still in baseball. They recently had an article on him on Sportsnet, and he's coaching in the Winthrop or Winsport. It's somewhere out in New Jersey. He's still doing baseball stuff, and he had a extremely almost 30-year career in the major leagues. So
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another player that had a really
very long time.
Very long
time. Even after 92-93.
Yeah, for
yep.
sure.
Yep.
All right, let's get to the Twitter poll here. And just really quickly about Pat, again, I stopped following him after he left the Jays and had no idea until I read this article in Sportsnet that everywhere he went after, so it was quite interesting. Mm-hmm. But the Twitter poll was, the Blue Jays paid Josh Donaldson $23 million this year in part to increase the possibility of re-signing him long-term. What should they do? And our options were trade or waive him now or try to re-sign him long-term. And the results kind of speak for themselves. 83% of the respondents said trade or waive him now, and 17% said try to re-sign long-term. So the Jays actually did something that our audience at least wanted him to do.
Yeah, and I'm interested to see what you think about all this, Rob, because you know your Blue Jays inside out. And I was trying to give that insight because the Jays threw that huge money at him so that they'd be able to be at the table and compete with the big boys when it came to try and sign them long term. But obviously things have gone really, really sour this year and that didn't come to fruition. At this point he hadn't been traded yet. He's now with Cleveland. But a lot of people were saying, yeah, given how things are, they should trade or waive him now. So what are your thoughts on the whole situation?
You know what? I don't think signing him long term fit with where the team is going. And you know, it's too much of a risk, I think. If it was 2016 Josh Donaldson, absolutely. He'd be a great asset moving forward for the young guys to see. But 2017, 2018 Josh Donaldson, and moving forward, you don't know what those legs are going to do. I think the whole setup for the season and the tone for the season right off the bat, the very first game against the Yankees, when he dead-armed across the diamond and he could barely get it to first base. And everybody, you could just feel the air being sucked out of the dome. And
you know, like you mentioned that, and there's an awful lot that hasn't really been exposed or really a lot that hasn't been talked about here because, yeah, I've mentioned it a lot this year that he initially had his calf injury and he thought he was going to be back. I think he was injured on a Tuesday and he talked about being back the Friday. It went on for 2 or 3 weeks beyond that. And I remember 3 or 4 weeks after the injury, he said, oh, yeah, I'm, you know, like 95% or 90%. He said, I just have minor discomfort running the base path, so I'm going to wait a little bit longer till I feel great. And then, you know, 3 months later, he's still not playing. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, he had that reputation as such a gamer. And then he's missing 3.5 months but then you mentioned the shoulder thing, which we all saw. And I didn't realize this until I saw it on, I think it was Tim and Sid, but they were talking about, he apparently had a bit of a beef with the Blue Jays because they brought in, what's it called, peak performance or high performance last year. And his other calf that was injured, he attributed it to some activity he was doing through that. And apparently going into this year, because he had a bit of a beef saying, I had no business doing that exercise, it led to an injury. So this year, he actually rejected the Jays' training program mm-hmm. and said, I'm doing my own. I'm taking my own guys. So that's interesting. But then you do your own training system and you come in, dead arm the ball, and then have a calf that doesn't allow you to play for 3.5 months.
Mm-hmm.
You can't point your finger at the team then.
Nope.
Yeah. Yep. So
absolutely. Yep. And that was his argument was, I've been doing these exercises all along throughout my career. I haven't been on the DL. And now you bring in, you change my routine, and now I'm hurt all the time. Mm-hmm. So he went back to his old routine, and this is still the result. And there's going to be talk of the turf and whatnot as well. But at the end of the day, he's 32, almost 33, as he's going into free agency. And the market isn't what it used to be. Odds are he's not going to get a huge contract this offseason. Similar to Bryce Harper, you know, I mean, he's having a down year too. So he's not going to get the huge contract that he was expecting. And he's going to end up signing 1 year somewhere. But they had to get something for him. And, yeah. You know, everybody's making a big deal about the Cleveland connection and all that. They haven't named the guy yet because he didn't clear waivers. He was on the DL. They figure they know who it was. Who it is, this Merriweather. He's still higher up in their prospect list.
I believe team. 12th or something like that, 12th overall prospect.
He's coming off of Tommy John, which isn't what it used to be. It used to just almost...
a formality, right?
Yeah, it used to be an end of a career type thing now. And now it's just everybody's having it, so...
Yeah, it's pretty common and a bit of recovery time, but they usually bounce back.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
yeah. Now, the thing with Donaldson, too, is like retrospect, you can say they shouldn't have signed him. But you know what? At the time, I was saying, you know what? The fans love him. He's a gamer. He's got the right attitude. And I have to say at the same time, I was actually really upset, probably more upset given the whole circumstances. I was more upset to see that they let Granderson go because anything I've heard there, like on the day he was traded away last week, Estrada had just pitched, and he was really upset with how things had gone for him. But when they mentioned Granderson, some of the phrases that came out of his mouth, he said, you know, he's a special guy. He said every single person in our room loved him and said that guys like Granderson don't come along often. And I heard different stories during the season where, you know, he was arranging really interesting trips on field trips where he would open it up to anyone on staff and anyone on the team. Mm-hmm. Like when they were in Kansas, he arranged a trip to the Negro Baseball Museum and stuff like that.
Yep.
And they had a group of 20 or 30 go. So just people were saying this guy is just really a pro and just drips real good leadership.
A real ambassador for the game anywhere he goes. And everybody rants about him. Really, the trade was more to do right by the player. Give him a chance to be in the playoffs again as he's getting older.
And do you think they have a chance to re-sign him? I'm not sure what his contract status is. Is he a
free agent? Yeah, it was only a one-year deal that they had him on. So they could bring him back.
That's what I was hoping for, maybe let him play, get some playoff action.
Come back. Yeah. I think he was just a great guy to have around the team. You know, it's similar to Jay Happ. I mean... it's good to see him go to the Yankees. I despise the Yankees, but, you know what I mean?
It's good for him, yeah.
But it is good for him. There's another guy that just pure class all the way. And to see him go through what he has gone through throughout his career, he struggled, he bounced around, he came back, then came back to Toronto with being a more of a finesse pitcher and figuring out what his stuff was and doing well that way. I mean, you got to give the guy an opportunity. And you got to get a little something for him, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, get a little something for him that way. And you know what, Jay Happ is, just to speak to the woes of the Jays pitching this year, he's still their leading pitcher as far as wins go. They're probably not going to have anyone else reach double digits in wins. He's still, with 10 wins, is still the ace of their staff, and he's long gone. Mm-hmm. The last thing I'm going to say about the Donaldson thing, too, is my one thing that irritates me a bit is this. They have that sliding scale on their tickets. If you get weekday tickets, certain seats cost, you know, a lot less than if you buy them on Friday night, Saturday night. You know, I went to a game earlier with a group of 10 or 11 of us, and we had seats that were not great seats, you know, past the outside the outfield fence, and we were paying $90 a shot. Not from scalpers, that's the face value, but it was Saturday night. And I keep thinking, you know what? that and the $13 beers we're all drinking, that was a lot of that was to pay for a $26 million salary. And then the Jays have plunked out a pretty much a AAA team.
Yep.
Almost a AAA team for a lot of the year. Yep. I think I would have liked to see a gesture from the Jays to bring ticket prices down, but that's not going to happen. Eh?
Actually, one of the bloggers I follow, I can't remember which one it was, did the Seattle trip because he's from out west. Did the Seattle trip where if they feel safe, go with Jays fans.
Yeah.
And one of their games, they did a bullpen game where they started relief pitchers because they had just traded Hap. There was a lot of influx with the staff. So they started a bullpen game. And he said, I paid for this whole trip just to see a bullpen game, you know? So, yeah, it is. It would be nice. I guess, really, you know, I was thinking about what I was going to say when I came on today. And really, I think from the top down, the team needs some work because there's just this cloud seems to be over them right now. You know, the senior management's really not real popular among the fan base. They've done some stuff that from changing the way ticket prices, you know, they got rid of flex packs. I had a friend who always got a flex pack, and he'd kind of divide it up amongst us friends, and we'd go down for a couple games every year. We haven't been down for like 2 years.
Because yeah, it makes it less convenient, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And he used to take his family once or twice. And they went and they fired all the PR staff. They walked something like 12 or 13 people to the door in one day. There's a lot of stuff going on with that they just, I don't know, they haven't really gotten off to the right, on the right foot with the fan base.
When you charge $13 a beer and, you know, $90 for a below mediocre seat, you
absolutely. Gotta absolutely. Yeah. Yep, absolutely. And they're really not doing anything to win us back. Yeah. That's for sure.
We need some fresh air that way.
Yep.
We got to sneak our second break in here, and we'll come back and talk a bit more to wrap things up here.
Yep.
So we'll be right back in a moment with some more baseball talk. We're back, ladies and gentlemen, on Baseball Talk. I have here with me Rob Whiteman sitting in, very knowledgeable about the Jays and baseball in general. I should mention that a familiar face on our show, Steve Fitzsimmons, he's running in a municipal election. So there's actually rules around that if you're a media personality, you're not allowed to make appearances. And so between what he does here and what he does with the Guelph Storm, he actually has to take a step away from that during the election run up until after the election. So that's why Steve's not here, but we're glad to see Rob is capably filling in for him. And we were going to turn the talk to today's latest rumor about what's going on in Jays land.
Yeah, Yahoo Sports is reporting that the Mets, the New York Mets, are on their list of potential general managers and presidents. Have Mark Shapiro and Ben Cherington, who's the VP of operations for the Blue Jays. Shapiro's only been here 4 years, maybe. Had kind of a rocky tenure with the Jays, and there's talk that he may jump ship. If that happens, you know, it'll be strange to see what happens all around to the team. Ross Atkins is one of Shapiro's guys. That kind of leaves him in flux. He has, I believe, another year on his contract. John Gibbons, who speculation has been that he's gone at the end of the year because he isn't a Shapiro and Atkins guy and has 1 year left on his contract and has basically said he's not sure he's interested in doing a rebuild with a youth movement. And his method is more geared towards the veteran players.
Yeah.
And does he end up leaving if Shapiro leaves, or do they keep him around? I know another blogger that I follow quite a bit and I have a lot of respect for is Dow of Steeb. Tweeted him the other night and said, what do you think? And he said, Sandy Alomar Jr., who has been linked back when they hired Farrell and then when they hired Gibbons back again to the Jays as a possible replacement. would actually be a pretty good fit.
Good baseball guy, yeah, for sure.
Got the pedigree. Former catcher who always makes... they always seem to make great managers.
Yeah.
And something that Jeff Blair from Sportsnet has brought up, that they the next manager should be fluent in Spanish because of...
There's been a lot of talk of that, yeah.
Yeah, and, Alomar would be the guy, you know. So he might be a good fit. But Shapiro taking off probably wouldn't hurt too many people's feelings.
Yeah, yeah. Now we're just hitting the rundown here, so I should pump the tires. Our next guest coming up, I believe it's going to be in 2 weeks here, but we have Rob McCoy, who's the head coach of Niagara University, an NCAA program, the rivals of Matt Mazurek's Canisius. And, you know, sometimes that works out because when I was soliciting guests for the show and then, you know, different people get back to you at different times and you go from having no guests to having a bunch of guests. So I look forward to getting his angle on that rivalry with Canisius. They also this past season had an All-American on their roster, so we'll get to talk some baseball there. So for Rob Waitman, for Andy Clark, this has been Baseball Talk.